This is David Barsamian, and my guest is June Jordan, noted writer, author, poet, and educator. She teaches at the University of California at Berkeley. She's also a regular columnist for the Progressive magazine. What's your perspective on the current situation in the Middle East?
I think a question that we need to raise that hasn't so far anyway been dealt with is the question of moral authority. I think that I wish that folks working with the Palestinian Authority and PLO would really kind of focus on this. How do you establish moral authority in international consciousness? What would be the means to that end? And you could start with Gandhi, you could come through Dr. King and so forth. And I think there could be some useful precedent for the establishment of moral authority, which will then lead to some kind of leverage on behalf of folks who are clearly very unequal, I mean completely unequal in what's described as a conflict, but really is more like a final solution, I think, underway. Vis-a-vis the Palestinian people. And I'm wondering how that moral authority could be pursued. And I think I wish a lot of folks would begin thinking about this. I have just a few thoughts myself. I've been thinking that, for example, let's say if I were I thought, God help me, but if I were, I think I would try to establish a deadline, set up a deadline and stick to it. For example, maybe say 5 days from today that there must be an international observation, kind of a core. At every point that I say we need such a core inside the occupied territories, and not dominated by Americans, of course, or representatives of the USA, and that failing that deadline, if that doesn't happen in 5 days, then I will do this, that, and the other thing. But I think he needs to. I think one thing that would be really helpful is for him to set out a deadline of that sort for the introduction of really neutral, so more, way more neutral than right now, observers and human shields in the occupied territories. Make it 5 days from now at the outside and stick to it. And then if the international community, particularly the European community, does not respond satisfactorily and or the United States blocks that, I think he needs to have a plan B. And I think he would then, for example, this is in the context of establishing moral authority, I think he might say something like, okay, we tried, we've been asking for such a third force agency since last November, all of which is documented, true, and since we can't get that, and since our people are being suffocated as they are and so forth, then I don't think we have any recourse but then to declare ourselves in a war of liberation against Israeli occupation of our land. And then turn around to the European community and ask for support for this war of liberation against occupation of our land. I think that this futzing around endlessly and this endlessly amorphous kind of deadline personified by Arafat is way worse than a discredit to his people and to the needs of the Palestinians. It's way worse than that. This is, children are dead and dying, and the population of young men and boys in the occupied territories is being decimated, and the leadership is being, you know, systematically assassinated. I mean, like, at what point do you say, okay, you know, and respond in some way that again, will accomplish the acquirement of moral authority? So that's one idea I have. I don't know what you think of that, David.
Well, it's no secret that the Palestinians have had enormous difficulty in making their case in the United States. Why do you think that is?
I think the the Zionist lobby in this country is really perhaps peerless in American history for disproportionate influence. I mean, given the number of people represented in of our total United States population, and on the other hand, the incredible policy and financial commitment that lobby is able to secure and command, really. I don't know if there's any precedent, do you, in American history for something like that? I mean, I say Zionist because there really are, as you know, there's an increasing number of Jewish Americans, for example, who want to end Israeli occupation. Do you know what I mean? Who are really flat out. I mean, Irina Klefis is just one. There's several folks. Rabbi Michael Lerner is another. There are many folks who are Jewish Americans who really understand that the occupation, the Israeli occupation, is unmitigatedly wrong. It's evil and heinous, and it must stop. So for so that's why I say Zionist, because I want to try to. I think one of the difficulties right now we're having in the progressive community, I think, is that folks are so desperate about what's happening in the Middle East that there's a tendency to conflate all Israeli people with the Israeli government and all Jewish people with Israelis. Do you know what I mean? And I worry about this. I worry about this. I think, particularly when things are so inflamed and so forth, is really if we, those of us who are progressive, really want to claim any kind of integrity, then we have to try and be as precise as we possibly can and not engage in the kind of stereotypic smear, swipe tactics that have so characterized those folks we're trying to dislodge. So I think that's one thing, is the lobby is just peerless in its effectiveness. I think, and I think another thing is that there's, apart from alternative media in this country, there's really exceedingly little information. I mean, honestly, I have been following as closely as anyone I know the whole situation, the plight of the Palestinian people since 1982. And for example, it was only this year that I saw a map of what we're talking about published in the New York Times once, and it was in a daily issue of the New York Times, not like a Sunday display, and it was not on the front page or anything. I mean, because once you actually see a map of what we're talking about, Nablus, you know, Ramallah, and so forth, and you see what the proposals are, and you see what the actual standing Bantustans are and so forth, a whole lot no longer needs to be said, you know? But absent that kind of information, just like a map, what are we talking about here? I think it's worse than uphill in trying to solicit and to educate mainstream attitudes and activism to stop this right now.
What happened in 1982 to spark your interest in the issue?
Well, in 1982, there was an Israeli invasion of Lebanon, and my friend at that time, particularly a woman named Lillian Strumber from Madre, she called me, and I was on vacation, actually, and she called me, and she said, "You have to get into it." I said, "I'm on vacation." And she started telling me this stuff, and I started checking it out. And the Israelis, first they said that Palestinians had murdered an Israeli ambassador in London. And then that wasn't true. I mean, honest to God, everything that the Israeli government said to justify this invasion of Lebanon was carried on the front page of the New York Times. Every one of those statements was untrue. The recanting of those statements, those completely erroneous statements, that never was came forward. I mean, anyway, this was radicalizing for me in a way that I don't think anything in my life really radicalized me so much until then, except for the so-called Harlem riots of 64, because I was there, and I saw what happened, and I was there, and I saw how the media handled it, and this was the only thing comparable to me, which was like, because here was what some government, in this case an Israeli government, was saying, and here's what was actually was happening or not happening, and then they pushed all the way up through Lebanon, I mean, right all the way into Beirut. I mean, it, as you know, it was just this horrendous culmination in Sabra and Shatila. I mean, it was just like, and I was like,
these are refugee camps, Palestinian refugee camps, in which something like 2,000 Palestinians were murdered by the Israeli allies, the Falangists. And the General Sharon was later implicated by an Israeli.
What happened was the slaughtering of Palestinian refugees inside this completely impoverished place in Beirut, Sabra and Shatila, could not have happened except for the fact that the Israeli soldiers made a ring around the camps and then shone these huge headlights into the camps so that the Falangists could see the men and the women and the children and then murder them. And also the Israelis bulldozed the bodies. It was Israeli tanks that bulldozed the bodies of the slaughtered innocent civilians. Anyhow, so this is when I became involved, and one of the reasons that I've stayed involved, David, is because, as was the case then, not quite so dire now, but pretty much, I'm like, where is everybody else? Like, this seems to be the Middle East situation. The plight of the Palestinian people appears to be the one taboo that nobody dares breach, you know? I mean, people talk about anything whatsoever, you know, incest, what have you. But they will not talk about, you can't even say Arab, you can't, let alone Palestinian. And I'll be damned.
You can say Arab terrorist.
You can say Arab terrorist, but you can't say Arab meaning, like, Arab American, you know, and in the same breath with, like, Chinese American, Arab American, Jewish American. No. It's a designation of somebody who is not entitled to fundamental human rights. And when I say fundamental, I mean very basic things, like the sanctity of your water supply, you know, the sanctity of your 5 olive trees that your father planted and that you wanted your son to, you know what I mean? I'm just talking very humble stuff here, very humble stuff. That kind of humility of human rights never been conferred upon Palestinian people and has never been acknowledged as something to which they are entitled. And it seems to me that at this time, as I said, it's not as dire as it's been, but it is still disgracefully this the case that many, many folks who are, I think, you're and my comrades, run scared on the subject, will not open their mouths. Or they say things like, I can't do it more than once a month. It's too depressing. I'm like, it's too depressing for you. It's too depressing for me. You know, I mean, it's understandable, but it's morally fatuous in a way. It's not really pardonable. So I'm also very, very interested to see, this is getting back to this idea of trying to establish some kind of moral authority. I think we have to really address the racist nature of the Israeli occupation, the racist nature of the Israeli usurpation of Palestinian lands and rights, human rights.
Well, how is Israeli colonization of Palestinian land, you know, different from what the British did in East Africa or the French did in North Africa?
Well, see, I think this is a means to the establishing of moral authority. For example, and again, I think a lot of folks don't know this stuff. That they're
true. Why don't they know it? Does it go back to the media again?
Yeah, well, back to the media again, which is why I'm so happy to be talking with you this morning. I feel that, for example, the parallels between South Africa and the whole what's so-called Middle East crisis, which this is called, are really not superficial at all. I mean, and they hold up to very close scrutiny, those parallels. And they need to be investigated, and people need to make that you know, move it towards common knowledge is what I'm trying to say. And the whole thing in South Africa, as in Israel, you have a really small minority of people who have arrogated to themselves the best lands and the most land and all the wealth and all the rest of it, and the other people are the other folks to whom the land really belongs and so forth. I see it as kind of shadowy at best, a shadowy threat. To really good, decent people and so forth. And the Israeli proposal for Palestinian autonomy inside occupied territories very much resembles the Bantustan proposals of apartheid. You know, I mean, you just have this dotted, discontiguous kind of a pattern, which has the effect of dispersing peoples so that they can't, never mind get together politically, but they didn't get to school, things like that. I mean, you probably know this, and there was a young Palestinian woman who, because of this pattern I'm talking about, and because of the Israeli checkpoints imposed upon all these different intersections within the occupied territories, she went into labor, and the baby was stillborn, because she couldn't get to the hospital because of the various checkpoints she had to go through. I mean, these are really crimes, these are not forgivable crimes. These are not. And these are not individual perpetrators of crime. These are state-conceived and state-sanctioned violations of another people. They really are.
So do you make a distinction between that kind of state-sanctioned action versus the individual actions of, someone who, say, you know, puts a bomb in a pizzeria or in a disco?
Yes, I do think so. I think this is a difference that we need to think about, but quickly and publicly. I've always felt this way, coming through the civil rights revolution in this country. I think there is a difference between state-conceived and state-sanctioned and state-executed violence against a particular segment of the population and individual violence. Yes, absolutely. I think this is, I mean, that should be clear. I mean, just as there's just a huge difference between, you know, having missiles and tanks and Apache helicopters and so forth, and having stones, you know, and a couple of rifles. When I say huge differences, I'm talking about life and death differences of life and death magnitude differences. And I think that, getting back to this concept of moral authority, I think it would be a good thing, simultaneous with what I'm suggesting that Arafat do, for example, that he say, as he makes these announcements, one or two, depending on what's necessary, that because now he, that is to say, the Palestinian people are now declared in a formal way in outright hostilities, a war of liberation against, you know, against the illegal occupation they're suffering from, that they say now, therefore, okay, all acts of elimination of the occupation, to end the occupation, will be happening in an organized, coherent fashion according to the Geneva Conventions, for example. Do you know what I'm saying? So, for example, there will be no more violence that I, Arafat, anyway, will sanction, for example, on the other side of the Green Line. And there will be no more, you know, pizzerias or discos or whatever other, in other words, if we object, and we do, absolutely, to the loss of civilian life on this side of the line, or whatever side of the line, we object to it across the board, okay? So we are talking about a coherent response to end the Israeli occupation that will mean that we will not have individuals acting out of this kind of destitute, desperation that you can understand, but you certainly cannot sanction. It's not okay.
The United States is clearly Israel's most powerful ally. It provides billions of dollars in aid. It provides political and diplomatic support. Why then, if that's the case, and that is the case, do the Arabs in general, most recently Mubarak of Egypt and Hussein of Jordan, and the Palestinians in particular, seem to be fascinated by and very impressed with the Americans and want them to be involved in the so-called rekindling of the peace process? Why would you invite the fox into the hen house?
I'd have to say it beats me on one level, but not really, not altogether. I mean, Jordan and Egypt are whores. I mean, right? I mean, they get a tremendous amount of money and support from the United States government, so that's not really mystifying. They're paid whores, but I think there's something more complicated going on here in relation to your question. When anyone in the world thinks of the United States, you think of all these things like equal rights, you know, freedom of press, sanctity of the home. This is the place. And I think everywhere in the world, Zimbabwe, wherever you are, Thailand, there's an association here, that this is the place that came up with these ideas sort of thing and has made a big play about these ideas. And so if you could get this place, the people of this place, if you could just reach them some kind of way, they would necessarily support your movements and your outcries for justice. And I don't think that's completely naive instinct. I don't think so. God knows it's my instinct, and I live here. You know, I live here. I mean, I don't know where I would go outside this country for recourse. Let me put it that way.
So wait a second. You're saying in the dispute between the Palestinians and the Israelis that the United States can be an honest broker?
I'm not saying the United States, meaning anybody representing, you know, from the Bush administration or for that matter, Clinton. But I'm saying that there are people here in the United States, there are Americans of whatever color, whatever ethnicity in this country, yes, who, if we could get ourselves organized, yeah, we could do something about this. I'm not talking about the people who go to Camp David. Well, I'm not going to be invited to Camp David. You know, I'm talking about, why can't we get this together to say, well, first of all, hold aid to Israel. It's conditional like everybody else's aid, United States aid. As long as they're committing these, you know, crimes, these war crimes against the people, and as long as they're pursuing these violations of the United Nations resolutions that they are, and so forth and so on, no aid. I mean, just just like that. Boom. We could do this. Okay? So we can do this. There are a whole lot of other people, including Jewish Americans, I think, who are ready to go. But we have to get this organized. We have to get this organized. And I think one of the things that we need to do is to clarify the racist nature of the Israeli supremacist history ongoing there in the Middle East. We need to clarify that, because I think once that is clarified to folks, I think a lot of people who are kind of running gun shy or something, I think they'll come forward. I think they might. And they'll understand that this is really another liberation struggle here. It really is, you know. This is another liberation struggle, okay? And it really has a racial structure to it. You know, it does. And
I've been to Israel a couple of times. It's a fairly prosperous country. Per capita income exceeds 15,000. In fact, it's better off economically than several European states. Nevertheless, it commands billions of dollars in economic aid from the United States. Simultaneously, the total U.S. aid package to all the countries of sub-Saharan Africa, that's Black Africa, is $700 million.
Well, see, now this is something, I don't know if we could put this on a bumper sticker exactly, but something equivalent to a bumper sticker, this is what I mean. If we could get that kind of information out, that's like a boom, boom. That's like a three-liner, right? That's what I mean. I think a lot of people will go, whoa, okay? Because you're talking about, for example, speaking of sub-Saharan Africa, as you know, we're looking at the wipeout, really, of most of that continent, Age is only part of it, but it's a huge part of it. And the United States is like mucking around and trying to look really good via Colin Powell, you know, talking about maybe we could up it by $200 million in aid, you know, to try and do something about AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. Maybe we could. Everybody knows that it's going to cost $8 billion, okay, to take care of this problem, to make a dent in Africa. And if I'm not mistaken, Israel every year gets more than $3 billion, isn't that correct, from the United States, which is my money and your money, by the way. For what? For what? I mean, this is racial. This is a racial breakdown here. And I just feel this is another example of something that is very specific, I think, that has to do with ignorance, you know. And I feel if we could mitigate this ignorance, this could contribute towards establishing a moral authority for this whole Palestinian struggle to be free, you know, to be free from illegal everything. And also, while we're at it, let's redistribute your and my tax money as far as foreign aid is concerned. I don't think my tax money should go to anybody unconditionally whatsoever. I don't think so. And I have a huge problem. I mean, what's the whole, the total population of sub-Saharan Africa, which is to say, as you say, black Africa, is, what is it, about 780 million, something like that?
780 million.
No, right. All of sub-Saharan Africa.
The APEC, the US aid?
No, the population.
Number of people probably doesn't exceed 300 million, I suspect.
All of So all of sub-Saharan Africa? Okay, so let's just say 300 million. Let's say not quite 300 million. Okay, someone else can do the math, and that would be a good thing for people to start doing some math here, okay? So let's say we have just under 300 million folks, and we've got, what did you say, $700 million in aid. So it's like $2 or something ahead.
And then a slice of pizza.
A slice of pizza, okay. In Israel, counting Israeli Arabs, we've got 3 million? Is it 4 million? 5 million? Okay, 5 million. And we've got, is it 4 billion a year altogether, including aid?
It's 3 up front. But the actual figure, as quoted by Rashid Khalidi of the University of Chicago, a Middle East scholar, he calculates it's up to $5 billion when you include all the donations to Israeli government funds and charities as such by Americans, which is written off your taxes.
Okay, so what's the math on that?
He says the figure is $5
billion. No, but I mean, so then if we divide that $5 million into $5 billion, what's that coming out ahead?
It's coming out to a lot of slices of pizza.
That's a big pizza. That's a pizzeria, right? I mean, so this is not, we're not talking inequity here, right? We're talking shocking, disparate distribution of public resources on the basis of race, I think, a supremacist ideology that's not yet acknowledged. It needs to be assaulted, but first of all, we've got to clarify that's what's in place.
You're a writer, and your trade is constructed by words. You're a wordsmith. What do you think if the word settlement were to be replaced by colony? Would that give greater clarification and understanding of what's going on the ground?
I think that would definitely help a tremendous amount, yeah. I mean, it's just like even in you know, USA history, you talk about pioneers, you talk about settlers. Well, from the point of view of the Native Americans, you know, this is a problematic choice of words. But to just talk about the settlements, and again, without the context of a map, so we know what we're talking about, and who has the water and the electricity and that kind of thing, it's not just misleading. I mean, this is very calculated deception. And it's taking place at the expense of a very humble people. I mean, you just said that the average Israeli annual income is somewhere around $15,000 a year. Well, I don't think that the average Palestinian income is much more than $2,000, is it? I don't think so. So, I mean, again, the differences are so extreme. The only thing I can think of to try and put this into context for folks, again, is South Africa. It's like, let's look at that. Let's look at the disparities, the wealth disparities, do you know what I mean? And and the income disparities and so forth, and compare them to the same kinds of disparities that obtain today in Israel and the occupied territories. The big difference, I think, there's a big difference, is that unlike South Africa, you and I are responsible for this. I mean, I never felt responsible any kind of way for apartheid. I felt responsible for joining with everybody I could to get rid of it. But I do feel responsible for what is happening to the Palestinian people in the occupied territories, because it's impossible without my tax money.
What do you think about the idea that in some bizarre way the Palestinians are paying the price for European anti-Semitism?
I had a Rabbi Michael Linder come to my class this spring, and it was interesting, he was talking about things. And as he was talking, he was giving kind of a history of the Jews, starting from Egypt, and it occurred to me, I'm like, whatever happened to Israel in relationship to Germany? Whatever happened to that? Where is that? Did that just... We hear about the Holocaust, right? But we don't hear about who committed the Holocaust. I mean, if you look at the mainstream media covering Israel today and Israel's concerns, security concerns, you would think that, I think, you might very well believe that the Palestinian people were the ones who perpetrated the Holocaust on the Jewish people living in Germany. I'm like, wow, this is unbelievable. And so... I don't think it's. I think there's something very weird going on. I mean, I don't quite understand how Holocaust survivors, could kind of skip over the people who created the Holocaust and who executed the Holocaust, and land, on really the agriculture peoples, with this kind of extreme venom, and demonization that they have, in fact, landed. I don't understand it. I don't understand it. But this, I think, is another facet, perhaps, of the racist structure of this whole thing, because the German people are, after all, they're white. I mean, they're white people, and the Palestinian, the Arab peoples will never be white people. They will never. And a lot of them are Muslims, and that is really problematic for us. That's another way. I mean, this is an example, but exactly, we have this conflation going on here. But we have that the Arab and Muslim, it's the same thing. And so the religion itself, it has become, it's become, like a villain. A villainous ideology.
Yeah, there's a new book out by Jack Shaheen called Real Bad Arabs, Real being spelled R-E-E-L. And it's about how Hollywood has demonized Arabs, making them the new niggers, essentially, terrorists. They're oversexed and salacious and have too much money and also are grossly incompetent, yet romantic and, the images of belly dancers and terrorists kind of juxtaposed.
Yeah, did you see Aladdin?
Yeah.
That was really shocking, wasn't it? I was like, oh boy.
A Disney movie.
A Disney Aladdin. I just couldn't believe that people were not all outside the theaters just going crazy. I'm like, whoa, this is ridiculous. Yeah, so, this is another facet of the racial, structure of this, I don't know if it would, I want to call it an emergency. I know it's been going on a long time. And it probably continued beyond me, but it's an emergency for the families living in the occupied territories today. It's an emergency for the Palestinian families who are not able to live in any of the occupied territories they were forced from. I think it's important to try to balance things. Yes, this has been going on a long time. But that doesn't mean it's not an emergency. It is an emergency situation in that sense. And I also think it's an emergency situation in such that this magnitude of injustice, I would hope, would define emergency for almost everybody out here. Are we literally waiting for all of the Palestinian people who are left in the occupied territories to either be killed or forcibly removed? I'm talking about Americans in this country, when are we going to say, whoa, stop? When? What will it take? This is very frightening to me because it's not obvious to me. As I see, but as I said, to me it's like an unfolding final solution here in process. You know, like,
well, that's pretty heavy imagery you're evoking. I mean, you're doing it quite consciously.
I am. Well, that's why I said unfolding. It seems to me if you have a policy, for example, of systematic assassination of anybody, of the leaders of a people, leaders that you think might at some point become problematic for you or who may have been problematic. There's no trial or anything like this, and there's no outright declared hostilities. And there's no effective international condemnation of this?
That's not accurate. Europe has been pretty outspoken.
I know, but effective, I mean, effective to cancel out the United States. I mean, us, our government. That's what I mean by effective. Because people have been doing a lot of things, France and so forth. I know, but then when things come to a vote, again and again, our government representatives, veto those sentiments, and they're more than sentiments. I think people are outraged elsewhere in the world. But we have the power, the United States has the power, to silence that outrage or to ignore it, just to ignore it with impunity. And that means that what the outrage is about and what has provoked the outrage really also then continues with impunity. And this is, I don't know. I'm hoping it seems to me that I'm very hopeful that there is an increasing number of Jewish Americans who are calling for an end to the Israeli occupation. I hope they grow in numbers very rapidly. I hope that more and more Jewish Americans in this country realize that it is really in their self-interest to act now so that the developing conflation of Jewish with Israeli and Israeli with Israeli policies can stop, because otherwise there are going to be anti-Semitic consequences here that I don't think any of us can really handle. I mean, in my class this semester, I came upon anti-Semitism really unexpectedly, I mean quite unexpectedly, and I was completely shocked. And I realized as I was having to deal with it, right then it was a crisis, I had to deal with it, I realized that, as I said to Rabbi Michael Luna, I will do what I can to say, well, all Jews are not this and all Israelis are not that, but it's not finally for me, a black poet, to be doing this, okay? And I never even suspected the presence of anti-Semitism at UC Berkeley until this spring. And I'm telling you, it's there, it's alive, it's virulent, and I think the source really is this catastrophe, continuing catastrophe in the Middle East. I do think so.
Do you care to elaborate on the, you know, what happened in the class, who the students were, the context?
Well, we had a segment called Arab American Studies, poetry and studying the Quran and stuff. And
that you were teaching?
Yes, that I was teaching. And one of my students was is Palestinian American, and she'd been in Jerusalem and so forth over Christmas. And she presented slides that she'd actually taken to the class, you know, slides of various things going on, which are shocking and so forth. And then there were questions and answers. I had 175 kids in my class. And in the course of the questions and answers period, this student, who's a very young woman, and heartfelt, but not really, all of this is all kind of new to her, she veered off into quite a few, I felt, anti-Semitic statements.
So is it, by anti-Semitism, you're equating any criticism of Israel?
No, I identify as anti-Semitic. Anything that says all Jews, da da da, or just like anybody saying all black people, da da da. To me, this is racist.
And the reason I say that is because some Israeli Jews say that because Israel is the state of the Jewish people, that criticism of that state is inherently and by definition anti-Semitic.
Oh, no, well, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying, that if you, in other words, if you generalize about any people, in this case it was about Jews, that that is anti-Semitic. And so...
And you're well aware that Arabs are Semites, which is, presents another conundrum for people.
I know, this is another thing. It's like, what do you mean anti-Semitic? Who, what? Exactly. So this was... it was really inflamed, and you know as well as I what was going on, meanwhile, or, you know, the context of what was really happening in the occupied territories and so forth, and I understood all this. I thought, well, we're for things in Poetry for the People's Mind program. We're not against things. We're for things. So I got up at the end and I said, okay, some things have now been said that I feel objectionable. I feel a little anti-Semitic. And it violated principle. Which in my program we had principles that whoever we're talking about, so to speak, or studying should talk for himself or herself. So therefore, for example, in our Arab American segment, you know, other than me, everybody who was talking was Arab American, you know, and we had somebody who was a Muslim come and talk about Islam, just, you know, and so forth. So I said, so therefore, for next week's class, I will seek and find a Jewish American to come and address the questions, what is a Jew? Are they all the same? Do they have differences or the commonalities? And I then sustained an attack, which is just amazing. I was conflated with Ariel Sharon for saying that I was going to seek and find a Jewish American. I was like, whoa, you're kidding. And it was really one of the most painful, shocking moments of my teaching career, that's for sure.
And were the students aware of your outspoken position for Palestinian rights?
Well, I would assume. I mean, there are not a whole lot of other people who have been quite as outspoken or, for that matter, as sustained as I have been since 1982. I'm on record everywhere, and you know. So, I was accused of all these things, and then I said, well, you know, whatever, but I'm going to do it. And then my students sent me all these emails, and they brought letters to my home and so forth and so on. And in the emails, they said things like, June, or dude, you know, I was just horrified you was going to bring a Jew to my class. I was like, what? These are sentences people wrote and put in writing and emailed to me. Do you know what I'm saying? I was like, whoa, whoa. So I went to my small class the next day, and I had all this stuff, and I was in such a state of shock, and I just said, yeah, this, and I said, you know, these kinds of sentences, I said, you'll have to live with this for the rest of your lives. I said, you should change the noun and try it, you know? I was just horrified you didn't bring a Muslim to our class, or my class, or, you know. What's happening here? And there was a kind of sullenness, you know? And I felt like it was more like, is June really upset than what we're talking about? And I said, there's anti-Semitism in this room. You understand what I'm saying? It's like, it's not about me and you hurt my feelings or you didn't read this. No, it's like, this is anti-Semitic. This is disgusting. And these people I work with all year, you know, since last September. In this room, I'm sitting with you. And that means in the big classes, 175, there's anti-Semitism going on, you know. And I said, this is disgusting. I was like, so I walked out. And then I tried to find somebody, and I tried to figure, who I'm going to find who's going to come into this environment? And I came up with this guy, Michael Lerner.
The editor of Tikkun.
Yeah, because he had reached out to me before the elections. He was arguing that this was for this election, we had finally not to go along with the lesser evil. And I don't know this guy, but I just thought it was very nice he'd reached out. I wouldn't know what I thought and stuff. So I thought, oh, well, I'll call him. And I had to tell him, you know, this is a kind of like maybe a really dangerous situation. And I don't know what I can do to protect you, but would you be willing to come? And the guy was a mensch. He came, you know. And he did, in fact, present a Jewish perspective. I mean, it was absolutely a Jewish perspective. As a matter of fact, he's absolutely not a Zionist, but it was definitely, his perspective was that this, that the land we're talking about, Israel, was really, you know, it was populated by Hebrew people from way back here, and, you know, it's a very definite perspective. That is his perspective. But I felt, that's right, he should have his perspective, and it's okay to have, he presents his perspective, and whatever, and nobody, there's no blood on the floor, you know what I mean? And when we got there, there was nobody there in the whole big room, and he said to me, it looks like we're being boycotted. And I thought, whoa, it does, because it's just him, me, and the student on the video camera. And it was 3 o'clock, at 3:20, the students came. We were sweating at 3:20. And he got up, and I never met this guy before, as I said before, but I had a lot of respect for him. And he said, I'm really sad that it was, that so many of you felt it was really controversial to have a Jew come to your class. And I thought, this is deep, you know, this is deep. I spent 10 years building a program, you know, to try and put Arab American people in the human mirror, do you know what I'm saying? Inside the human mirror, the human being mirror. And then, you know, closing out with anti-Semitism, it's like, whew. So I'm trying to suggest here, this is a cauldron, and it has consequences for all of us, it really does. And I don't see enough folks willing to just bite into this, okay? Just bite into this some kind of way, and make it different really soon. Really soon. That's why I said, if I were Arafat, I would say 5 days. 5 days. Let's go. There's a lot of venomous perversion taking place inside people's spirits now. And I think one of the things that happens is if you suppress people so long and you distort people for so long, the possibility of sitting down and talking with people and not one of you having to get killed before you leave the table evaporates. I really believe that. I don't think we have much time.
But getting back to the United States, and you know, you're calling for more people to bite into this issue. It's hard to bite into an issue when you're the target then of retribution, of vitriol, of the most hateful kind of comments like Jew hater, anti-Semite, you know, and you know, Nazi and stuff like that. I mean, that's happened to me.
Yeah.
If I did a radio program with Edward Said,
yeah.
You know, people call me up and say the most, you know, ugly things.
I know. Well, did you read the Irina Kleppfuss piece in the Progressive? Well, she was okay. And as she said in there, I mean, it really is time. I'm quoting Irina Kleppfuss. Okay, it really is time for Jews to find another touchstone in determining good and evil besides the Holocaust. Okay, it is time. This is not to minimize the Holocaust. This is not to trivialize it, but to say there are other people in the world, too. And there is other suffering in the world. And it is time, we don't have to go to the Holocaust in order to say something is wrong. Okay? We don't have to use the word Holocaust to say something is hideous and wrong or a crime. And so I'm really hoping that, I've never been intimidated by people calling me anti-Semitic. I was intimidated by being called anti-Arab, I gotta tell you. I was like, what? You know, I thought, geez, you is. You know, this is surrealistic. But when people call me anti-Semitic or Jew-hater, I just say, whatever you want, you know, it's fine. Because that's too ridiculous to me. That's suggesting that there is a particular people on the planet, and also that there's a particular state on the planet, in this case Israel, and the people, Jewish people, who are above and beyond criticism. I'm like, I don't think so. I think every single one of us, starting with me, is most worthy of criticism and tyranny and disagreement and correction, you know, and Hey, because otherwise we are talking the supremacist ideologies. I said, that's supremacist. If I can't, if there's one group of people and there's one sovereign state that I cannot say anything about, I cannot criticize, like every other people in every other state, we are talking about a supremacist status for that people, a supremacist status for that state. And I'm like, no, that's not okay with me. And I would hope that folks would be emboldened to say, no, you call me whatever you want to call me. But, that's because otherwise what happens is that just really provides for a continuing silence here. And what I was trying to tell you in answering your question in such a personal way is that silence barely covers a cauldron of response, okay, that will happen here. It will happen in this country, okay? And it's not going to be pretty. We have to have people becoming able to speak without recrimination and name-calling and so forth. And just the facts. Just like I say to you 4 million and you say, no, June is 5 million. Just the facts. Let's just go for it. Let's just go for it. And if I'm incorrect, correct me. If you're incorrect, call in and say, no, according to the New York Times Almanac, da-da-da-da. Let's just deal with some very basic stuff, like aid, you know, United States foreign aid, like that, per capita implications of that for sub-Saharan Africa or the Israeli people. We can just do that.
Tell me more about Poetry for People.
Poetry for the People?
Yeah.
The idea was to provide a place where folks who are ordinarily not in the canon and not studied, not understood, would have their space. And so eventually what came out of it was a kind of a deal where, for example, this spring we studied African-American peoples, then we did Chicano Latino peoples, then we did Arab-American, like that. And we tried to understand the worldviews of those folks, and so we did liberation theology, we did, you know, Christianity, the Old Testament, and studied the Quran, and like that. And it's been an oasis for folks. They also write, you know, I encourage people to write in their own language, their home languages, and, mm-hmm. and publish in their own home languages and present their poetry and so forth. But the whole thing about the poetry is that it should not be wasting anybody's time. You know, it should be something that really matters to you that you want someone else to know about. And it's been, I think it's been a good thing. And we have, we just finished the 5th year at Berkeley High School, you know, and
so you have community outreach as well.
Yeah, at least a 10-week program at Berkeley High School, and each semester, that is to say. And this year we also resurrected our program at Glidden Royal Church, working with folks coming through various recoveries programs there, and folks needing English as a second language assistance. And we've done some prison work as well.
And is it well supported by the university?
It has really been very well supported, I have to say. The only thing is that I have wanted to do something else. And I'm not an administrator. I'm just not. I'm a poet. And from the beginning, I tried to set it up so that it would just be go, you know, and I could go ahead and do something else. And the university really has kind of made it into a cult thing, you know. Like, if I don't do it, it's not going on. So I'm calling their bluff this year. I'm not doing it.
But there are other people in the program. There are other teachers in the program.
No, that's what I'm saying.
It's a one-person show?
Yeah, it's it.
And you are Poetry for the People.
I am Poetry for the People, which is ridiculous. So I'm like, just before I came out here, actually, I got a surprise of $20,000 from the university so I can keep the Berkeley High School thing going. And what I want to do is use that money to bring folks from, like, Philadelphia and New Haven and L.A. who are running programs that they call Poetry for the People, which are very different from my own. I want to bring them to UC Berkeley and let people listen to these people, you know, and see. This is really not a personality thing. This is an idea. You know, it's like bread. It's like that. and have these other folks talk about why they're doing things the way they are doing them, because they are. And hope that on that basis, the program will revive and other folks will take it on and run with it.
And there's a book with that title, Poetry for the People.
Yeah.
Who published it?
Yeah, that was Routledge Press. Well, see, there, that's proof. See, I was trying. It's called a blueprint. That was a long time ago. That's like 4 or 5 years ago. Put that book out so that people could just read the book and run with it. You know, I mean, the whole idea is it's an idea. It's not a particular person. It's an idea, and just do it. So, as I said, I just got the news of the $20,000. So if I can't get a conference together with that, as you know, you're not right.
You're gonna put a conference on?
Yeah, I want to. I'm gonna bring these folks in from Philadelphia and New Haven and L.A. And if I hear, I think there's some people doing something like that up at Humboldt too, farther up north in California, and bring them in and show off what they're doing.
June Jordan is a noted poet, writer, columnist for the Progressive magazine, and professor at the University of California at Berkeley. Thanks very much, June Jordan.
Thank you. Thanks, Dave.
I'm David Barsamian for Alternative Radio. Thank you for listening.